This week on the Design Review, we continue this long-running mini-series on cognitive psychology and discuss the psychology of numerology. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Design Review. My name is Chris, and this week, Jonathan is AFK again. He messaged me earlier that he wasn't feeling very well. He's a little bit under the weather. It's not COVID. I mean, something is going around, and it's not just COVID. He has basically like a cold or flu or whatever. He said that he's feeling okay, but his throat is still kind of scratchy, and it's probably not a good idea for him to be talking on a podcast if his throat is hurting, because it probably won't sound good, and it probably will, you know, hurt his throat a lot. So this week, John is away, and so I will be doing this show by myself. It is episode 95, by the way, which is a great milestone. For us. But anyways, without, too much more chit chat, let's start talking about this. We're talking about numerology of all things. How this started was, I was looking over the previous shows on cognitive psychology, and I realized that, you know, we had only done about 9 episodes so far. And I thought, well, it's kind of weird to just leave the series at 9 episodes. And so why not just make it an even 10, right? Like, do one more show, make it an even 10. We could certainly continue the series, for a lot longer, because there's plenty of psychology topics to explore. And there's absolutely no reason to just leave it at 9 even, or 10. But then it occurred to me that this idea, this thought that I just had, like, oh, you know, 9 is weird, but 10 is okay. You know, that is a weird psychological thing right there. And so, why, you know, I started asking myself, like, why is it weird to have 9? Like, I could just leave it at 9 and not do anything about it, more or less. And so that's what I want to talk about today. I looked into it a little bit and got into some interesting research on the psychology of counting and of numerology and superstition. So what am I talking about? So, I mean, it might sound like some weird hippie thing to be talking about numerology, especially for a design podcast, because what the heck does, you know, what does these things have to do with each other? But at least as far as I'm aware, there are a great number of cultures from all around the world that have really injected meaning into different numbers, right? In the U.S., we consider the number 7 to be very lucky, and we consider the number 13 to be very dangerous, right? I know in China, the number 4 is incredibly bad, but the number 8 is incredibly fortuitous. And, you know, in some countries, odd numbers are good and even numbers are bad. And in other countries, even numbers are good and odd numbers are bad, you know. And so, you know, like it or not, these various superstitions or beliefs are really part of who we are as a species. And it helps shape how we see the world around us. And so why is this topic even a matter for design? That's like probably the number one question you're asking yourself right now. It's like, why am I even talking about this? Well, believe it or not, these ideas, that numbers possess a sort of deeper meaning, it actually does impact the work that we do, right? If you think about it. So what do I mean? So for example, imagine that you're trying to design a UI for displaying lists, like big lists of items, like lots of things, right? And maybe you're designing like an online shop, And you know, on the back end, you know, there's all the different products that the storefront has for sale, and you know, it's a big database of things that has like, you know, the item, the price, description, sizes, colors, you know, inventory, like how many there are of it, right? There's probably a bunch more other metadata in there. But your job as a designer is to figure out how to display all this in a UI. Now, a common paradigm for a solution would be to have like a big grid of all these different items, you know, maybe with some navigation to help kind of sort it out a bit. But you know, there's a big grid in a long, you know, vertical page. And when you tap on something, you know, it opens a new view that contains the details of whatever it was that you just tapped on. And that big grid, you know, it has a certain number of rows and columns. And as a designer, you have to decide how many rows and columns are supposed to be on the page. Right? And so the question is like, you know, do you use 5 items per row? Do you use 4 items? Do you use 7 items? Do you use 13 items? You know, these are all things that you have to sort of figure out. And depending on what you choose, somebody might have pretty strong opinions on why that choice is good or why that choice is bad, right? And that's both internally and, you know, outwardly. The customer might also have a very strong reaction at seeing, you know, X number of things. And some of that feedback, of course, might be purely about monetization, right? I want you to display as many things on the front page as you can, because that's how we're going to make the most money. That is an assumption, of course, but you know, that is, you know, some of the feedback you might get. But some of it might also be just based on superstition. You know, 3 is unlucky, so please don't use three items there, something like that. And so regardless of you know, whether it's about monetization or just superstition, it's an instance where somebody's beliefs about numbers, you know, actually does impact what you're doing. And some of that might even be just be you, like you as a person, like you have these certain beliefs too, right? It doesn't have to always be, you know, somebody else saying it. Another situation where this stuff plays a role is around pricing, right? Obviously, setting the price for something, you know, it involves establishing a number value for how much somebody ought to pay for, you know, some goods or services, right? In the US, you know, if you were to set the price of something at, let's say, $13, that might actually cause some initial concerns. It, for no other reason than it being the number 13, right? And so, like, if you go to the store, it's like, how many items in the store have you seen that cost exactly $13, right? Where the price tag says $13. Maybe you've seen $12.99 or like, you know, $13.50, something like that. But, you know, how many times have you seen exactly $13, right? It's weird, right? And of course, you know, another way in which this kind of impacts design is looking at metrics and analytics. And not just because of the data itself, but, you know, people have superstitious beliefs about lucky and unlucky numbers, and how that sort of impacts people's perception of various situations, right? And if you know, I've certainly been in conversations with people when studying data, and you know, we look over a chart and you know, it sort of indicates a certain trend and people have certain reactions to it that some of it might be, you know, just based on the data, and some of it might be based on some weird superstition about what's going to happen at certain times, you know. I've certainly been in those kinds of conversations. But you know, like imagine, for example, you ship the 13th software update, you know, for a product, you know, that actually does cost $13, and then it's performing very poorly because it only has 13 customers, right? Like, what do you think, you know, somebody in that meeting is going to talk about, right? 13 is unlucky. Okay. And then furthermore, last few other things, like, Apple, I believe, skipped software update 13, right? They jumped right to like 14 or something like that, simply because of Triskaidekaphobia, right? And like hotels, they hardly ever have a 13th floor, right? Like there's elevators out there that like simply don't have the correct numerical sequence because of superstition, right? And we don't question it. Like nobody ever questions the fact, like, oh, why isn't there a 13th floor? And it's probably even the reverse. If you go to a hotel that does have a 13th floor, it's like, well, I'm not staying on that floor. Screw that. Yeah. And like I said, it's not even just like internal company matters. It's also the customer that can react in these types of ways, right? So if a customer sees a product for $13 on Friday the 13th, it's like, oh, I'm not buying that. But I've also mentioned I've also heard in usability testing, people make these sorts of comments about things that were sort of like, oh, this person might be a little bit superstitious about stuff. And so now that we understand a little bit about how this impacts design, I started to kind of wonder, well, what's behind all of it? Like, there's obviously some psychology to this, and what's kind of happening behind the scenes. And so I started to research a little bit more into superstitions and different things, and like how numbers have meaning. And a lot of it obviously does connect to superstitious beliefs or folk tales, but even if we don't believe in the superstitions or the folk tales, we are usually at least aware of their existence, right? Like we know the stories, we know the like fairy tales or whatever, and we probably even believe in them to a certain degree, right? And as mentioned, this stuff happens all over the globe, right? It's not just in the US. It's not just in, wherever country it is that you're listening to this podcast from. It's literally every country on the planet has some sort of, superstitions and myths about numbers and unexplained phenomena. And so what's going on here? Like, where does this all come from? Well, it turns out there is, in fact, a principle of psychology that explains what's going on, and it gets at the nature of superstitions in general. Now, I'm about to read a little quote here from an article written by a university, and it sort of gets at the psychology of this. All right, here goes. Superstitions stem from a misinterpretation of scientific facts or from urban legends. Some are as simple as placing trust in lucky numbers, as we've been talking about, or could be things like putting empty bottles on the ground for good luck. Jason Parker, a senior lecturer at Old Dominion University's Department of Psychology, said the root of believing superstitions is adventitious reinforcement. Adventitious reinforcement is when a person begins to worry something bad is going to happen because of an action they took. Whatever they did beforehand is believed to be the cause of the expected outcome. So, everything, revolves around adventitious reinforcement, right? And this word, adventitious, what does it mean? It doesn't mean bold or daring or somebody going out and having an adventure. It actually has more to do with the root word advent, which is the coming or arrival of something or someone that is important or noteworthy. But in this case, adventitious implies something that comes up as a result of something external or accidental. And so we can start to see that superstitions occur when we sort of accidentally reinforce certain beliefs about events that aren't actually true. This applies to all manner of superstitious beliefs, right? There was a famous ghost story of a family during the Victorian times. They moved into a house, a new house, and they believed it eventually to be they believed it to be haunted, because you know when they after they moved in, you know all their plants started dying, the children were getting sick, they started you know hallucinating, they were seeing all kinds of weird things in the house, and you know when they would leave the house everything was fine, like everything went back to normal, but you know whenever they were inside there was like just these weird creepy noises and like just weird things happening in their vision and all this strange phenomena happening. Well, it turns out they weren't in fact haunted. It turns out there was a carbon monoxide leak from the furnace, which was basically slowly suffocating them, and they're poisoning them to basically, and that's what was causing all of the weird problems inside the house. And it makes sense because you know when they would go outside, they would actually get some air, and you know things would get back to normal. But you know back in the house, they were suffering actually from oxygen deficiency rather than ghosts and spirits. But we can see in a situation like this how all of these negative events, without any other actual evidence, it was accidentally reinforced and connected to this idea that the house is actually haunted, when in fact it was just carbon monoxide poisoning. I mean, it's not funny. It's the carbon monoxide poisoning is not funny. But it's just funny to think about how that happened, right? Another way to think about adventitious reinforcement is when people correlate things that aren't connected, but then claim that there's some sort of causal relationship from one thing to the other, right? People do this all the time, right? We've heard about this, causation, not correlation, you know, sort of thing in pop culture science. This is one of the things that, you know, correlating things together is sort of at the root of adventitious reinforcement, right? Especially when we have data that isn't quite complete, right? Just like in the haunted house, they didn't have a complete understanding of what was happening. And especially because, you know, carbon monoxide is invisible and odorless. There was no way for them to just tell from, you know, their five senses what was going on. It's basically connecting these two different things that sort of aren't really related, but reinforcing them in a way that gives a wrong impression. And so why does this happen? Why do we do this as a as a species, right? Psychologists have conducted many studies over the years to understand adventitious reinforcement. One such study goes back to 1948, conducted back then by Berhus Frederick Skinner, who worked with pigeons and tried conditioning them using randomized rewards based on certain operant conditions. And this thing, his research, basically became known as the Skinner box, which relates to a psychological principle and possibly even a dark pattern around conditioning that is still used today in a lot of software. We've certainly talked about the Skinner box before in relation to dark patterns and ethics and all of that stuff. But there's a lot of products that use Skinner box type mechanics in order to elicit more quote-unquote engagement with a product. In further studies with pigeons, conducted much later by Staden and Simmelhag in 1971, and then again in 1985 by Timberlake and Lucas, showed that, you know, perhaps the things that Skinner was doing maybe didn't quite work the way that was originally claimed. And I'll quote from an abstract from a white paper that they wrote. The results provide additional evidence that the quote-unquote superstitious behavior that emerges in pigeons and other organisms under response-independent food schedules is the result of elicited species-typical food-getting behaviors, and that these behaviors emerge as a result of frequent food deliveries in environments that support such foraging repertoires. So what's going on? So basically what they're saying is we connect, or pigeons in this case, pigeons connect certain events together simply as a result of their food gathering and foraging behavior, right? Which is connected to, you know, like our desire and our need to survive and how we interact with the world around us, right? And if you think about how this works, back in sort of the early days of human civilization, you know, we needed to know how to gather particular food items at particular times of the year so that, you know, we could more or less ensure our survival as communities and as people. And as a result, we learned to correlate certain things that were happening in our environment to the advent of certain food items, right? And this was a way for us to make sense of what was happening and when we knew to go and gather them, right? You hear about this all the time with, like, you know, don't harvest XYZ thing after a full moon or whatever, right? These were all, sort of the folk tales and superstitions that developed as a result of various cultures, observing different events in the world and connecting them to regular cycles of food gathering. Another study conducted in 1997 by someone named Stuart Weiss attempts to show, quote unquote, how complex and paradoxical human behaviors can be understood through scientific investigation, and profiles personality traits associated with superstition and the role of superstitious beliefs in one's actions. Weiss acknowledges that superstition is a normal part of human culture, but suggests we learn to critically evaluate the source of our beliefs in order to develop alternative methods to coping with life's little, yet sometimes overwhelming, uncertainties. So effectively, what Weiss was studying was trying to, like, debunk myths and superstitions and try to understand how we end up believing in these different things, and then sort of trying to demystify the sort of correlation versus causation relationship dynamic. It's all connected, as I mentioned, like, to certain psychological principles that seemingly relate to just innate behaviors, right? Of how we understand and interact with our environment. In a previous episode in this cognitive psychology series, we talked about something called misdirection, right? Misdirections help reinforce these types of correlation experiences, which can become superstitions later, right? We can trigger people to believe in different things simply by misdirecting their attention on the wrong events or ideas, right? One example would be a magician. A magician uses sleight of hand in order to misdirect your attention so that you ignore the sort of obvious thing that he's doing with his other hand, right? That's the whole nature of it, right? And so as a result, you might end up believing that, hey, this guy is actually a wizard or something, and so, yeah, that's how misdirections also help reinforce myth. Okay, so we've talked a little bit about, you know, why this matters for design. We've talked about why it sort of happens. There's certainly a lot of psychology behind it. But what do we do with this now, right? You're probably wondering, if you've listened this long, you're probably wondering, like, well, what the heck do I do? Why should I even care about this? What do we do with this? As designers, you know, now that we have this information. And to quote the sort of rather famous or infamous designer rebuttal, it depends, you know, it depends on the situation and what sort of superstition, you know, somebody is using. But, you know, here I've wrote down some things that you can do, which maybe helps you kind of navigate those situations. A lot of, I think, I'll just say right now, a lot of what I've written down, a lot of it has to deal with kind of the internal problems that you might face, because those things sort of directly impact your productivity. But there's an outward component too. So first of all, know your audience and understand what beliefs they might have, right? I think this is the most fundamental thing, is just know who you're working with, know who you're dealing with, know this, try and understand the beliefs that they have, so that when you engage with them in conversations and dialogue, that you know whether or not something might irritate them or trigger them in some way. So, like if you're designing, for example, a UI for the Chinese market, for example, I would recommend refraining from using, groupings of four, for example, or associating, with the number four, because, as I mentioned, in China, the number four is sort of seen as a very, very bad number. You sort of don't really want to connect important things to the number four. But the number eight is actually very fortuitous, right? And there's a weird anecdote that in the US, when the US basically ran out of all the 1-800 phone numbers, right? That's why we see a lot of 1-888 phone numbers nowadays. But when around the time when the US ran out of 1-800 phone numbers, there were a lot of Asian American business owners who were scrambling to get the most auspicious 1-888-888-8888 phone number. And for obvious reasons, because eight is seen as very lucky in Chinese culture. Asian American business owners were really trying to get that number. I think somebody did. I don't remember what the number is. You could probably call it if you want. I'm not gonna actively promote that, but if you want to call it, go ahead. But depending on what market you're trying to serve, there are many, many different cultural variations of this exact concept from all around the world, as we have been saying, over the course of the show. And so if you're designing something for another culture, make sure that you understand these various different, beliefs and superstitions and things as part of the culture, so that you avoid making, certain cultural faux pas. This idea also works internally, right? So knowing your coworkers is just as important as knowing the customers that you're going to serve, right? Because you ultimately will have to make presentations to your coworkers about things. And you want to be sort of careful about the types of things you put in that will be triggering. Or if you do understand it, use it to your advantage. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, you have to know your coworkers, and what's funny is, like, I've seen this happen where even the most rational people that you might work with can still be very superstitious. It just happens, right? People who are really smart, they sometimes have really different sort of opinions about things. It's just that's what happens, right? And so, I mean, don't be caught off guard if you encounter it, And then the next thing I want to talk about is this idea of experimenting, right? Experiment with superstition, right? We all know that superstitions exist. We all might believe in them to some degree. If it comes up in a work discussion, where, somebody's saying, "Hey, we shouldn't do something because of blah, blah, blah superstition," maybe propose running experiments to confirm whether or not what they're saying is actually true or not, right? Rather than just accepting what they're saying is at face value. And this is true in any type of situation where somebody's beliefs or opinion, might get in the way of something progressing, right? It happens all the time, right? Where somebody says something that maybe sounds weird, and they don't really have any evidence to back them up. But what do you do? Like, how do you deal with it? Well, the simplest answer is just to test whether or not what they're saying is true. And so, yeah, you can politely challenge them to suggest running, suggest running experiments to confirm what they're saying, right? That's how we get at the truth. That's how we get at understanding where they're coming from and how we make better decisions as people, right? The interesting thing about all superstitions is that there's actually a shred of truth behind them, right? That's what makes them powerful. Just like in The Magician, even with magic tricks, right? Like there's a shred of truth in magic tricks, and that's why it looks so believable. Superstitions are not just fiction, right? If they were just fiction, it would be easy to just like, oh yeah, that's just fake, right? That's not real. But superstitions often have an element of truth, which is what gives a myth or a belief like that. It gives that stuff credibility, and yeah, just like the haunted house story, right? Like these things were actually happening. Plants were dying. The kids were getting sick. They were seeing all kinds of weird stuff, and so there was evidence to suggest that maybe there is a poltergeist in their house, and it's a wild belief, but there were these things happening that they couldn't explain, and it just turns out that it was carbon monoxide poisoning. And so how do you handle this? So don't attack the person, obviously. It's really about confirming the assumption that they're making, right? So if the person is repeating a superstition about numbers, and if they happen to have a fairly strongly rooted position that, their belief is correct, challenging what they're saying might actually feel like a personal attack, right? Simply because, they've always believed that, the number 12 is just really unlucky for them, and like I don't want anything to do with 12 because when I was at 5 years old, I was spanked 12 times by my dad. I don't know, something like that. Well, running a test would just help confirm or reject what they're saying, right? And so it is really important when you're trying to like work with that person, that you're simply just trying to understand the situation by testing these types of assumptions, right? It's not about them. It's just we need to understand whether or not that's a real thing or not. They might still feel insulted at by doing that, but that's kind of a them problem at that point and not a you problem. And your emphasis really should be about gathering evidence. The last thing I'm going to say on this topic is around ethics, of course. Try not to abuse people's beliefs, right? This is a really important thing. Even if you have all the evidence to back up what you're saying, right? Like in that story, like if the person is still just firmly rooted in this belief that the number 12 or whatever shouldn't be used, you might have to take an L on that one and just sort of back off a little bit in order to avoid dealing with more difficult consequences or situations later. And if we think back to how real this can be, there was a scientist that we now know by the name of Galileo who was put on trial for heresy because he had evidence to support that we live in a heliocentric universe rather than the common belief at that time, which was that planetary bodies revolve around the Earth. This has been proven to be untrue, but it was so widely believed at the time that they were willing to execute Galileo for heresy for even suggesting that things were revolving around the sun. Manipulating people by abusing their superstitious beliefs can quickly become a dark pattern, right? I mentioned misdirection earlier. That is primarily the mechanism that you will be using if you're trying to engage with dark patterns. Misdirections, basically are the fundamental ways in which you trick people. So don't do that, right? Use evidence, as I've been saying, like collect the evidence. so that you can make your points more effective. It's also just so that you have some integrity. It's important that we use evidence, right? That's how we move forward. In situations sometimes where evidence doesn't exist, your task as a designer is to start gathering evidence, right? It's hard sometimes because, you know, you might look at a situation and go, well, it's easier for me to just like make the changes. And yeah, maybe it is. But sometimes it's better to also just put that aside and gather evidence, right? This stuff can still cause issues at work because we all know people don't like doing research, right? You use the R word at work and people get really anxious or sometimes even visibly upset when you even mention the R word. But gathering evidence really does help reduce confusion and ambiguity and all of the weird opinioneering that goes on in companies on a regular basis from week to week, every sprint, all kinds of opinions get thrown around. So evidence is really important. There are different ways to gather evidence, and they don't always involve running A/B tests, right? People are still, in 2021, people are still very fixated on running A/B tests as the only way to get any kind of validated claims. But realistically, there are a wide array of evaluation methods besides A/B tests to collect the types of data that might be useful. You know, A/B tests only give you a certain type of result. And so you should use the methods that are appropriate to the types of results that you're trying to get, right? Why would you, you know, why would you run an A/B test for something that doesn't require, like multivariate studies? We've talked a lot on the show about research, research methods, things like that. There was an episode a while back about, you know, the importance of research. So if you want a really in-depth conversation about research, you can certainly go back and listen to that show. I don't want to get into that right now, especially since we're at like, you know, 30 minutes or so. But yeah, research is really important. I know the R word is offensive to some people, but it's a key part of what goes into making great products. So that's about it for today. I think I've taken enough of your time. And so we can summarize. So, you know, this is episode 10 in a series on cognitive psychology. And while perhaps not directly a superstition, for some reason, I felt that having 10 episodes was better than having 9 episodes. And after looking into it more, this whole idea connects back to the psychology of numbers and numerology and superstitions, which can all be explained as something called adventitious reinforcement. Adventitious reinforcement is essentially the accidental confirmation of a causal connection between unrelated things. It has been confirmed to exist over the years in various scientific studies and impacts many things in our everyday lives. As designers, it's important to understand the superstitions and associations that exist in the world, and specifically for the people that we're designing for and the people that we're designing with. It's all a part of user research, and in situations where we need to challenge people's beliefs on this stuff, in order to break down some of these incorrect assumptions, it is important to follow an ethical practice around evidence gathering. Thank you for joining today. I hope this was interesting for you. I hope it was enjoyable to hear. It's a little bit lighter, I think, in terms of the types of content we tend to talk about, but, you know, it's getting into the holidays and it just seemed like kind of an interesting topic to discuss. And especially because I feel like sometimes we tend to repeat a lot of the same types of things. You know, having a little non sequitur type of episode may be kind of fun for you. But anyways, I hope this was useful. I hope this was kind of interesting. And there is research out there that talks about it. Certainly, if you'd like to know more about adventitious reinforcement, you can do a Google search. There's plenty of information out there on that. Anyway, if you would like to support our show, if you've enjoyed our content, if you've enjoyed the episodes that we've been putting out over many, many years, you can actually become a regular monthly donor to our show. And you can do that simply by going to anchor.fm/designreview. And on that page, you can hit the support button. And when you see it, you can select a dollar amount. It can be as low as, you know, $1 and all the way up to, I think, $25 or something like that. But, you know, if you've gotten something out of the show, it'd be really nice for you if you could help support what's going on. It helps us do more things, like get better microphones, etc., etc. Anyways, we are also on Twitter. The show is dr_podcast. I am Machine Human and John is Design UX UI. Feel free to reach out to us on any of those channels. We are happy to engage with you all on stuff like this. Also, if you can, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It really does help the algorithms find our shows a lot more frequently. And we will appear to more people. So even if you don't want to be a monthly donator, you can help us simply by writing us a review and giving us a good rating. So that stuff really does help. Lastly, I will again mention it because I've mentioned it on many shows. There is mentorship available to you. So if you have questions about how to deal with superstitious people and conducting research to break down some of those superstitions, by all means, go on to officehoursproject.com and find somebody on there to talk to about it. Also, by the time this show goes out, I may be adding a new mentor, so I'll probably have an announcement on Twitter or something for that if you're interested to talk to them. Thanks again. I really appreciate y'all listening. This was a really fun show for me to sort of research about, and I hope you enjoy it. We'll be back again in a couple weeks. Probably that would be in the new year, actually. But yeah, if we don't see you before then, have a happy holiday, and we'll see you next show. All right, bye-bye. Bye. See you later. Happy holidays. Don't eat too much holiday food. Stay home. Stay vaccinated. Stay safe. Don't get sick. Don't get COVID. All right.